to another episode of Medical Narratives with Dr. Michael Gordon. I'm Regina Starr, and today we're discussing a topic that many seniors and their families face at some point in their lives, the challenge of deciding when to leave one's home for congregate living, such as a retirement home, an assisted living facility, or a nursing home. To help us with this complex issue, joining us today is Dr. Michael Gordon, an expert in the care of the elderly. Hello, Dr. Gordon. Welcome to the show.
Hello and good morning.
So let's get started by addressing the first hurdle many families encounter. Why is it so hard to make the decision to move into congregate living?
Well, it's kind of intuitive. Most people like their homes, especially homes they've lived in for many years, in which they've raised families, they have associations, and a comfort level. So asking somebody to leave their home, not by their choice, but by necessary circumstances, is not easy. And there's a natural resistance. And in fact, when you read people's commentaries, often so-called experts say, if possible, people should age in their homes. And that sounds intuitive. The problem is, it's not always possible. It's not always possible for a very wide range of reasons, including economic, health, family. So it's not easy, but at times it has to be addressed.
That's understandable. What about the individuals who just don't think it's the right time?
Yeah, so this is a matter of, in a sense, judgment. Now, most people don't think it's the right time because they don't ever want to move. Some people know it's the right time and take the initiative. And I recently saw a couple in my practice that the wife was sent to the clinic for cognition problems and memory and forgetfulness. And when we talked about their living situation, the husband said, we've already made plans to move into a retirement home, which we're moving into in the next month. And I said, why did you do that? And the husband said, well, we decided better to do it now when we can than when we have to. You might say, oh, that's the ideal situation, where people consciously make the decision for the right reasons. So it's hard for a person to say, I'm ready now. Often people will say, I think it's a good idea, but not now. And the problem is not now is, well, when? And I always say, and I think we're going to discuss this later, when is the right time? And unfortunately, the right time is before the necessary time.
So another common concern is the fear of losing friends. How can that be addressed?
Yeah, well, this is one of the reasons that people are reluctant to move in the first place. So the home itself, the building, the house, the apartment, has associated memories, and they're important. And also a lot of people not only have associated memories, the house is full of memorable things. Even in those who are not hoarders, and of course many people are, I'm speaking from experience, personal experience, and my parental experience. And, you know, you say, well, it's just things, but it's not just things. All these things, it's like sometimes you're cleaning something up in the middle of trying to clean things up, and I find a package of pictures, and all of a sudden I'm looking at pictures. And these are pictures of, you know, a family dinner 30 years ago. And of course, it brings back memories. Well, you say, well, you could put them in an album, but of course you can. But the one house that you're living in for years has memories, all kinds of memories. And of course, some things you could transfer and you move, pictures, et cetera. But usually, if you're moving from a home into a protected facility, you have to downsize. So there are a lot of obstacles to making the choice unless the person already believes that's a good choice. So when they don't believe it's a good choice, it's hard to convince them.
Right. And what about the logistics of the move, such as distance, the concern who will visit, how often family will visit?
Yeah. Well, it goes back to the previous question. Besides the house, you have a network. Everywhere you live, people have neighbors, friends, you know, confidants, all kinds of people, and we get used to them. It doesn't matter where you live, unless you're a real loner, you get to know the people in your neighborhood, and often you have connections with them. When you move, you often lose those connections, although sometimes you can maintain them, especially if you move someplace close to where you lived. But the actual logistics of moving, depending on where you live, is not easy. I mean, finding a place is one, and we're going to discuss that, I know, later, how to make sure you find the right place. But there are all kinds of issues to deal with, the geography, access. If you have a family and you want to move someplace that's less close to them, how are they going to visit? When are they going to visit? Will you become isolated from them? I mean, we say, oh, now with the new technology, it doesn't matter. They could be 50 miles away, but you could visit them on Zoom. But until they figure out how you can hold your hand on Zoom and hug somebody on Zoom, maybe they'll come up with that also. My goodness. You know, it's not the same. So people have a lot of concerns. And moving to a place in which you don't have the network that you had where you lived, and you can't be sure of how often your family's going to visit you, can be a very daunting experience.
Yes. So cultural and religious issues can also come into play. How can families navigate these concerns?
Well, depending on one's values, culture, background, religions, there may be, and depending on where you live, there may be facilities that are geared to your particular values, religion, etc. Now, in metropolitan large areas, urban areas in the United States and Canada, you often have affiliated organizations. So for people of that affiliated group, usually you can find a place. So in Toronto, for example, there are large organizations for the Jewish community, for the Italian community, for the Asian community. The Asian community is expanded to include the Southeast Asian community. There's a very nice home for the Greek community. But there are communities that have large populations that don't have designated homes. And for them, it's a problem because they may have cultural, religious, culinary desires and values that are not going to be met if they moved into a standard secular municipality-run home. Now, when that happens, and it happens a lot, there are often agreements that the family can bring in the food, so that eating the culturally appropriate food, that whatever the religious needs are, that can be arranged. And I've seen that even in Baycrest, which is, in a sense, a Jewish-oriented organization, but it's also a publicly funded facility that all kinds of people come in for all kinds of reasons. We've had priests come in to provide last rites, celebrate holidays, have a place where they can hang a, have a Christmas tree, and all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So depending on where you live, that may be a possibility. But if you live in a smaller community, it may not be possible in that community. And I can recall many years ago having an urgent request from a family doctor up north in the end of the world north for me, Halliburton, whatever. And he happened to look after an elderly Jewish couple. They were the only Jewish couple in the community, small community. And they had always, over the years, gotten their kosher meat brought up from Toronto, et cetera. Well, one of them was ill, the wife, and he, the family physician, felt that she should come down to Baycrest, but was worried about the husband. And in those good old days, we were able to arrange that the wife came in to be evaluated, and the husband came down and was admitted to, I think, the nursing home temporarily. And they eventually moved down to Toronto, where they actually had family, because they wanted to be in that environment. Mm-hmm. And I've certainly seen the same in all the other communities. I used to do work at the Yi Hong Center, and for sure, they have 5 campuses. So there are many places around the city that people of that community can go and be close to their families. So there are a lot of issues, especially if you have very strong cultural, religious needs, to find a suitable place. But most places, even if they don't ascribe particularly to that culture or religion, will usually find a way to meet those needs.
What about the cost? I know cost is a major concern. How can families address the financial aspect?
So this depends, and it's interesting, different in the United States, it's different in Canada, it's different in each province. So let's say Ontario. In the Ontario long-term care system, that's nursing homes and homes for the aged, they're all under the same legislation, the Long-Term Care Act, and their funding is the same, which means the government pays a certain amount of money per day per resident, and the resident pays the difference. And if the resident has no income, not assets, no income that allows them to pay beyond what they get from social assistance, they pay what they can minus from their social assistance, minus a daily allowance, which is supposed to be for hearing aid batteries, for toothpaste, for personal essentials. So for nursing homes, in many ways, it's the best financial because it's not based on assets. Like you're allowed to own a home. Some people think that's ridiculous, but in the United States, they make you sell your house in most states and they make you pay down, but it's your income. So most people can go into a nursing home, whatever their financial situation is, and pay the same per diem across the board. And if they don't have anything other than their old age security, et cetera, that will be what they pay minus the living allowance. For retirement and assisted living in Ontario, and that may be different in other provinces, I think it's a bit different in BC, they're private enterprises. They come under the Housing Act. They're congregate living, and anybody who's been there knows they can be very expensive, moderately expensive, never cheap. But there are some that are very high quality that are not exorbitant. And what you get is a very modest, but usually very nice arrangement, often with a bed sitter, sometimes a one bedroom. And meals are provided, sometimes two meals a day, sometimes three meals a day. Usually they have a healthcare system where they have a clinic in the building and they have either physician that comes. Some people keep their own physician. They may have a nurse as the primary contact person. Some of them are very expensive. There are a number of chains. I won't make the names, but people can look them up that have very good reputations and are quite splendid in terms of their layout and the apartments. The meals served are often of a very high quality. Obviously, they all have to fulfill certain standards in terms of the nutritional content, but people don't eat because of nutrition. I mean, they eat because it's an enjoyable activity, and sharing it with somebody else is one of the reasons people who may have been otherwise alone in their apartment find a congregate living very fulfilling because they meet people. Sometimes they meet people that they knew from years ago. I've known many, many situations where somebody meets someone who says, my God, they were from my village, and they named the village. And then they have a network. So depending on your financial situation, you may not be able to afford retirement home. Maybe out of the question. I've had situations where the parent was in the retirement home and doing well, but the family said, we can't afford it anymore. They were collectively paying for it. And the mother was deteriorating to the point that the retirement home or assisted living was saying, you have to bring in more help. And they said, well, we can't afford more help. We can't even afford this place. And what they did, they applied for a nursing home. And the problem is the wait was fairly extensive, but they eventually were able to move. And the nursing home was very good and met the needs of the parent. And the cost went back to the basic cost of a nursing home. So it's a complex equation. You know, people nowadays can take out, if they think of it early in life, long-term care insurance. I know I applied for it, but for me, it was too late. That because of my age, et cetera, the premium was so high that it wouldn't have been worth it. But if you think about it, like all insurance, it's one of the packages that insurance brokers promote. You can take out long-term care insurance so that if the time comes that you need long-term care, and that could include home-based long-term care, like home care, PSW care in the home, and then institutional long-term care, this insurance pays for it. In fact, there are two insurance products that I promote. One of them is critical illness insurance that you pay a premium, and should you develop one of 10 or 15 serious illnesses, you get a very large payout. And if you don't use it, you get your premium back. And for me, it turned out, because I developed a malignant blood disorder, that I ended up cashing in a very substantial insurance policy that paid for almost half a year of my not working. So there are a lot of financial situations that you have to take into account, and sometimes you may need to discuss them with a financial advisor who knows the system and which one is, you know, suitable for the person and for the family.
Very interesting. So zeroing in on the various scenarios that typically compel seniors to make the move, what are some common things that happen?
Yeah, well, the one that I, because of my practice, now see the most is those who are developing cognitive impairment / Lyme dementia, living at home with usually a spouse or maybe with children, and their needs have gone from being able to be met by the family, maybe with a little bit of help, medication, and they gradually are not able to be maintained in the home safely. They start wandering, so they have to put in all kinds of gizmos to make sure they don't wander out of the house, alarm systems and things like that. Some of them are simple and they work. But then there's the concern about accidents in the home. I've had situations where the older person, who happened to be a woman and used to cook, would turn the stove on and then forget to turn it off, and there would be fires. That's an issue for the family, but it's also a public health and fire hazard issue. Difficulty doing their own self-care. So then the family either has to do it or they have to bring somebody in. And many families do. But you often get to the point, and I've had this said to me at least once or twice a month, where whoever the family member is usually says, I just can't do it anymore. It's just tearing me apart. Some of them say, and I have children, and I have to look after my children, so-called sandwich generation. You're looking after your parents, you're looking after your children. And as I often say, and you're it, like the children's game, it, you're in the middle. So that often is a precipitant. And one of the problems, depending on the degree of cognitive impairment, dementia, the waiting list may be long. And one of the issues now, certainly in Ontario, is if you apply and they offer you a place, if you don't take it, you go to the bottom of the list. So you feel that you should take it. And sometimes I tell people that's the right time to take it when you can. And if you don't, they may move you to a place that's mainly, if you've been in a hospital, out of your district. And that's a real problem, because that may mean the family can't visit you readily when you lose contact. So other scenarios, which I find when I used to do a lot of acute care, is if somebody has a severe illness or an orthopedic catastrophe, often a broken hip, pneumonia, and it becomes clear that they can't go home in their state. So they have to be admitted from the hospital, usually to a nursing home. And if they haven't already been on a list from a nursing home, they're applying for scratch. But even if they've been on a list, doesn't mean they get bumped up to the top. They just are in the queue. And as I said, now they can move you if you call an alternate level of care. It means you don't need the acute hospital anymore. They can move you to any nursing home that has a spot, at least temporarily, and that may be far away. But depending on the system, you apply for the hospital. They do whatever they have to do, the hospital, rehab, whatever care, and they eventually move you to the nursing home. And that's there's no alternative. The family understands, and the person usually understands if they're able to understand it at all. If somebody goes into the hospital and it turns out, and I just had a situation like that, it turns out that although they went to the hospital because of an orthopedic problem, when they were investigated, it found out that they actually had metastatic cancer. And because the cancer was in the bones, that's why it got fractured. So they went from an orthopedic rehabilitation issue to somebody who actually needed either oncology care with chemotherapy and radiation therapy or palliative care. As it were, the person had been a nurse and said, I don't want chemotherapy, radiation therapy. I want to be moved into a palliative care unit. So that's different because palliative care isn't long-term care, but it is usually moving out of the hospital, unless it's a special hospital that has palliative care, into a facility that also does palliative care. So there are many scenarios of why people end up either by design, by planning, by urgency, by change of family situation. They're at home with a spouse, the spouse dies, and the children can't pick it up. So that becomes an urgent admission. So there are many scenarios, and the flexibility of the long-term care system is a bit of a problem, especially after COVID. Number one, many people are very hesitant about moving into long-term care because they heard all these stories. Many people are very choosy. They said, I want long-term care, but only, and they name the place they want because that's their preferred place for religious or cultural reasons. Well, many of these places have very long waiting lists because the community looks to them as if you have to take me, after all, I am. And having worked in one of them, being I am doesn't help a lot. You join the queue, and it's a long one. And even though they keep expanding, there is a shortage. There's been a shortage. There's been a lot of lobbying over the years to expand the long-term care reservoir. And the alternative is to enhance the in-home care program. Because as it is now, home care provides a limited amount of help. What it provides is very good, but it's limited. And therefore, the difference is private. And private can be very good, but very expensive. And I went through this personally. It was not long-term, but it was short-term. And I got some help from CCAC, which was wonderful. But because I have a spouse that's working, and she was worried about my being at home, I had problems with falls, I had a private, as it were, a companion who was a nurse in her mother country, which she eventually got. But while she was with me, she was worked for an agency that gave very good care, but it was very expensive. So there are lots of scenarios that, depending on the situation, you have to choose one or the other. And there are people, some of them are, you might say, professional navigators. Often they came from backgrounds of social work, occupational therapy, and they work with families to help find the best resolution for the challenge. And I had one, it was actually the first day I was working at my new clinic, which is a cognitive assessment clinic. And the person who came to me was the daughter, the mother of three children. One lived in Montreal, one lived in Toronto, and one was a pilot who was in and out. And she didn't have dementia, but what she had was actually an age, late onset psychosis. She was hallucinating, delusional, thinking people were coming after her, whatever. Her cognition wasn't bad. And she understood there was a problem. And they had looked at a long-term care facility that I knew about. It was something that used to be something else. And I knew the person who had been the previous director, and it was very good. And it was a faith-based organization. And they happened to be of that faith. And they went there, and they were told that there was a room available now. And they basically said to the mother, this is the room. Are you ready? And she said, yes. But they said, we can't take her if she's hallucinating. We can't look after that. So the plan was to start her on a medication to deal with that before she moved into the home. And what happened is when I followed up, I discovered that she actually moved into the home the next day or the day after she saw me, before they had a chance to start the medication. And of course, that night, she started seeing things and started screaming. So they admitted her to a general hospital where they put her on that medication. And a week later, they transferred her back to the home, but she was on the medication at a much lower dose than I thought she needed. And when I called to follow up, I spoke to the nurse who said, they're still having problems because she is. And for some reason, the family doctor didn't get connected to this. So I was able to recommend increasing the dose. And it took two or three phone calls till she got on a dose that decreased her hallucinations. And I know that things worked out because I knew it because I stopped getting phone calls. In the last follow-up, I was told that she was doing all right. So there are a lot of scenarios. And each one, there's no kind of universal answer. Each one has to be dealt with based on the family, the relationship in the family, who the players are, what the values are, cultural, religious, social, environmental. There's a lot of things that have to be done. And those who do the intake, for even the proprietary nursing homes, they say, oh, they're just in it to make the money. But they know that if they bring in the wrong person, they're not going to make the money. They're going to lose, but more importantly, they're going to lose their reputation. Because nobody wants to go to a place that gets a reputation that, oh, if they don't like you, they throw you out.
Right.
So it's a delicate balance. If I were in charge of policy, I would make the long-term care system, the whole system, part of the publicly funded system, and find a way to have the spectrum include the equivalent of assisted living, retirement living. But financially, that's a very big stretch because a lot of these retirement homes are really hotels. And there's now a move even to certain cruise liners, literally turning them into large retirement homes on the sea.
Oh,
and some people say it's a good deal. Three meals a day, right? No overhead, no need for cars. Your family can't visit easily, but you go into ports. And as long as you don't get seasick, you have a good time.
Interesting concept. Great, great insights. Now, for those who are ready to explore congregate living options, can you give us the breakdown for what is an assisted living facility? What is the long-term care? What is the retirement? What is the difference between those?
So there's basically split between the two. The nursing home, long-term care, usually means the person, in the Americans, they call it nursing home, and what we would call chronic care, they call skilled nursing facility. It means you need a good deal of medical and skilled nursing care. Medical, medications, help with activities of daily living, bathing, some help in toileting. You have medical conditions that need injections. There's a lot of things. Now, a lot of these things can be done elsewhere if you have enough staff. But nursing home staffing is much greater than, let's say, a retirement home, which has minimalist staff. It doesn't have healthcare staff as the staff. It's like a hotel. They have a receptionist. They have people who clean. And then you can get certain medical things done like a la carte. Like I worked in a retirement component at Baycrest, and you could arrange to have your medications given to you by the nursing staff. That was an a la carte arrangement for which there was a fee. I don't know if at Baycrest seems to fee, but most places. So that's a nursing home. And those are the ones that are subsidized by the government. And as I said earlier, even if you don't have money other than your old age security and whatever, that's as much as you'll pay minus personal allowance. Then you have the retirement home assisted living. So that's part of a spectrum. They used to say retirement home. That sounded like, and they had them in the States, these big estates for seniors living, and they see them advertised and the tennis courts and the mini golf and whatever. But then they found that as people aged, they couldn't do all that, but they didn't want to leave. So they had to put in another layer that called assisted living, which meant you still had this nice environment in your little bungalow, but now you had care provided also usually on an arranged basis. It might mean somebody came in to give you medications. Somebody came in and gave you an insulin injection in the morning if you needed one, or this or that. And the assisted living usually had a range of conditions that they could look after safely and appropriately, as long as you weren't becoming a risk to yourself or others. And if you were, then they would have to say, we don't have on site the next level, which is a nursing home. Now, some of these organizations have expanded, so they cover the waterfront, and the attraction to an applicant that says, you can stay within our campus. You start off retirement living with your lovely apartment and your little cabana. Then you move to, in the same building, assisted living, where you now have people coming and helping you. And then if you deteriorate, you move next door to the, and the reason that's good is if it's a couple, for example, and I had the same situation, not only I saw at Yihang, but also at Baycrest, where one member of a couple were able to maintain themselves in the retirement home assisted living, but the other required the nursing home. But because they were on campus, the visit was easy. It was either just walking or taking a little minibus around in a circle. So there's a range, and depending on where you live, the range includes separate, distinct, part of a network, or all on one campus.
Thank you. Thank you. So finally, once admission is secured to a long-term care facility, what strategies can families use to make the transition easier?
I think this is very, very important. And part of this I learned not only from my professional situation, but having observed how my sister dealt with our late father when he moved against his wishes and preferences to an assisted living entity about 10 minutes from where my sister lived. And it was clear that he was living alone in our house that I grew up from my teens in Brooklyn, and my mother had died, and he was gradually deteriorating. And he had medical problems, and he was self-medicating, and the house was a disaster. And he kept saying, no, no, no. And one day, after it became clear that he really was cognitively impaired and suffering, my sister, who is the social worker, said, Daddy, we used to say, can you, will you? She said, you have to move into a protected environment. You have to. No ifs, ands, or buts. And he had previously applied to move to Toronto because I was here. And at that time, I thought it would be great because if he did need help, I would be able to help facilitate using the system. But that was long past. So he agreed. And knowing his personality, she said, look, we're going to do a trial 3 months near me. He knew the place because he had been to where she lives many times, near me, and it's a 3-month trial, and we're not going to sell the house, close it up, and he agreed. So he moved in, and, you know, he found it was okay. He started making acquaintances, this and that, but he kept talking about when he goes home. But the important thing is we got a doctor who I knew very well, because she had done some of her training in Toronto, got involved with his care and helped deal with his medical problems. He had pain problems, which he was self-medicating, so she put him on regular, well-tolerated pain medication. She ultimately decided I concurred, putting him on one of the medications that addresses cognitive mild dementia, and he actually benefited. And he was socializing. He had been almost a hermit in his house. He'd go out in the morning, buy a bagel in the New York Times, and that was it. So he started improving, and after a month, he said, I'm ready to go home. Now, my sister and I knew his personality very well. He's a survivor of the Depression. So she said, Daddy, we've already paid for 3 months. If you go home, you're going to sacrifice, and I don't remember I'll make up the number, $2,000 that we paid. He says, I won't do that. I'll stay the 3 months. So, of course, what happened is over the 3 months, he developed some problems, one of which he calls her in the middle of the night. I won't go into the details, but she went to the house and helped him get through the night. And with a combination of, you'll get a hint from what it is, medication and suppositories, he completed what he had to do, and he said, you saved my life. Sell the house. Right? So the 2 months extra we had was enough for him to realize he couldn't do it on his own. Because when he had something like that, when he was at home, he'd go to hospital, which is not a good way to go. Certainly not where he was living. He went to a city hospital. So he agreed. We moved in. We signed all the papers. We did all the stuff. And then my sister and I went and arranged to sell the house. And he was shocked when he heard how much we sold it for, because he said, we only paid, I'll make up the numbers, $35,000, and you sold it for $175,000. That's crazy. It's in a prime neighborhood. It's now worth, probably it's another house has been built on it, but easily $500,000. So, you know, you have to follow through with what happens. You can't anticipate always all the plays and just go with them and be creative.
Thank you. Thank you for shedding light on this challenging but very important topic. To wrap up, any final thoughts?
Well, one of the thoughts I have, and I've seen it many times, and I went through it, is children often feel a combination of duty, obligation, which they should feel. I always quote the Ten Commandments, number 5, honor thy mother and thy father. It's not easy, and it says so in the commentaries. It's not easy. It's a challenge. You have to honor them, and therefore people often feel guilty. I can't do it. It's not. So you have to remember part of your duty is not only to honor them, to make sure the best arrangements are made. And the other thing, and it's a little dictum I say, because remember, if this becomes too much for you and you fail, that's like to the children, the spouse, they fail. Like if you can't do it, they're going to go into a nursing home anyway, but you won't be around. You have to remember that, because they'll say, I'm under a lot of stress. I can't juggle everything. I don't know what to do. You say, you can't afford to fail. This is also, you're taking care of your father, mother, because we're going to maintain you. And what you could do now is make sure you visit your father, you show that you're there, and you make sure the staff know you are a very devoted child, and you're going to make sure that they get the best care without alienating them. When I say alienating, because you have some children who start second-guessing, the worst are people who are healthcare professionals, second-guessing every decision that's made, you have to find out what are the rules of engagement. There's a primary care physician. They're supposed to discuss with you a change of medication. That's all. Or if you see something, you can say, you know what? I noticed that my father is da-da-da-da-da. So that's like you would do anywhere in the clinic. But you have to show the staff that you really care, and you care about them, and you respect them. And little things mean a lot. Celebrating holidays. I mean, it's Rosh Hashanah now. I can assure you that in many of the Jewish, let's say, but it would be the same if it's New Year or Christmas, facilities, the families are bringing gifts for the staff, not to buy them off, but to show appreciation.
Of course.
And a box of chocolate goes a long way.
Absolutely. Thank you, Dr. Gordon. Thank you to our listeners for joining us today on Medical Narratives with Dr. Michael Gordon. We hope you found this episode valuable. If you have any questions or topics you'd like us to explore in the future, please feel free to reach out. Until next time, take care.